Next case is 99-23-08, Sandy Bar Association versus David J. Young.
Responded to that, has she not?
She has.
And what's your response to that? It sounded perfectly logical to me. And she said, court hasn't decided it yet, and this is what they might do, but she knows the Supreme Court pretty well, and you can never guess that. It's about what it said.
I understand, Your Honor. I've been here enough to understand that as well. But I think the importance of it is this. We're on newly trod ground, if you will, in this particular sort of disciplinary rule.
But are we, you know, we've read the brief, we understand everything you're talking about with regard to the underlying finding by the commission or something like that. It occurred to me when I was reading all of this that if a lawyer or a judge were charged with some criminal offense and the charge went to trial, and because there was not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, there was a finding of not guilty. But pretty clearly, if you took a clear and convincing evidence standard, you would have convicted. Does that then preclude, because there's no underlying finding of guilt, any action by this court for the kind of conduct that occurred here?
Well,
that for most part was admitted, or a good part of it was admitted.
I don't think it's admitting, Your Honor. I guess that's... we can address that in a moment.
Yeah.
Let me address your subject area, your legal issue first. You're talking about two different burdens of proof in a situation where you have somebody tried in criminal court under a beyond reasonable doubt. There's not a beyond a reasonable doubt standard in assessing whether there's an underlying issue in this particular case by the appropriate authorities. Rather, it would be preponderance of the evidence. So the record which would be made, if it were done, as we submit to the courts and to the administration agencies, would not have that sort of burden upon it. Moreover, you would not have a situation, if you look at DR 1102, you talk about engaging in illegal conduct involving moral turpitude in a situation you posit, Your Honor, or perhaps engaging in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation, none of which suggests to anyone that there need to be some a priori legal finding. However, when one looks at the language of DR 1102B, you find the words prohibited by law, including in that segment. And if you look at that in comparison with a prior version of this, a draft version of this, which was not adopted, which I submit would have been far more vague in terms of how it should be interpreted for this, I think we have to conclude that there has to be meaning attributed to prohibited by law at this time.
Okay. I understand your argument about that, again, and I think that just repeats what you said. What I'd like to do is go to the underlying question. Do you have any objection, in my understanding, I thought you agreed, to the portion of our report that is entitled Substantiated and or Uncontroverted Facts?
Yes. I think we take issue with it. I think we tried to brief it.
You did? Where? I thought that there was an acceptance of the fact that he had talked about the Great White Hope. I thought he agreed to that. I thought he talked about that he gave the woman a nickname, and I thought that he talked about the fact that, and the thing, a lot of that stuff bothers me, particularly the sexual connotations, but what really bothered me, I guess, as much as anything, is you got this law student sitting in your office saying, you better toe the line, because when your character and fitness comes up, I can control it. And if I give you a bad recommendation, you'll never be a lawyer. Now, that's exercising power improperly, isn't it?
I have an issue with that. Some of that may be the nuance of the language that might be used. The issue is this. Mr. Young did indicate to a number of people that he would give recommendations, bad or good, when he's inquired because he's been an employee. That was not to say or to imply that there is a tie-in between that and some sort of improper conduct that he's after in terms of some of these employees. When we look at it in the context of the other cases where this court has sanctioned an attorney or a judge for trying to influence something, we have something that is far more egregious in all of those situations. Here we have somebody saying, you know, if you do a good job, I'll give you a good recommendation.
Okay, let's go to a different fact. Then if that's amorphous and a little difficult to pin down, how about that Jennifer filed a criminal assault charge against him and the matter was resolved through mediation with her getting $7,500, the next part is interesting, as part of a confidential settlement. It's not very confidential at this point with all this filed. But here, he pays that. She filed a criminal assault charge against him. And that was settled. Now, that's a specific, isn't it?
That is.
Does he object to that?
That's what he's being charged with in this instance.
Well, but the underlying thing of, is this the conduct that an attorney should have, he or she, in their offices, vis-a-vis other people?
I understand. And we understand that attorneys do occasionally get upset, do act improperly in an instant. And this is what we're talking about with respect to this instance. He was, and I think it's the facts, which I believe are...
I remember the facts. The answering the phone, get off the phone. He said he grabbed the phone and just accidentally hit her, I guess.
Yes.
Knocked her down or over or something.
The photograph, which is front and center of one, I would understand that that's what happened. She did not come to testify in this proceeding. So we don't have her as a complaint about that particular incident. It's represented.
I guess where I was heading with this is that I didn't think there was any dispute about that portion of our report entitled Substantiated and or Uncontroverted Facts.
No, let me suggest that I believe it was in the section where certain comments, inappropriate comments during Elizabeth Crowe's interview process were taken as fact. Based upon her testimony, Mr. Young denied it, even though Ms. Crowe said that Mr. Young's wife, who was frequently in the office, was present for this. She said she never heard such comments. That was discredited because she was his wife. And finally, the office administrator, who was not even called as a witness by respondent or relator, but was called by the board, Cole, who had never spoken to Mr. Crowe at that time, was called in. And she was questioned about the incident. She said it never happened, and she was there.
But didn't he admit, and now I'm remembering what came to me, didn't he admit that he even, because of that conduct, gave her an apology the next day and said, I was out of line? Didn't he admit that? That's uncontroverted, I thought.
I don't recall that.
You don't?
I don't recall that. It's insane.
Well, go ahead. I'll find it.
I believe that she said that that's what happened. We have a situation here in the classic sense of the word, as it relates to Elizabeth Crowe and the conduct alleged about Mr. Young, of one person saying one thing and another person denying it. And as it relates to the interview, three people denying it, yet
yeah,
the one person is credited. I think this is the difficulty with this type of case being, if you will, the case upon which to premise sanctions under DR 102B, particularly a sanction of the severity that has been recommended in this instance. There's too much in the record that, despite the fact that the panel says it's uncontroverted or substantially uncontroverted, that truly is not the case. Indeed, the point we make is, in addition to that, a legal issue. But the substantive issue as to whether or not his conduct would arise to the status of creating a sexually hostile work environment is not demonstrated by the facts in this case. And in this respect, we try to analogize to the cases decided principally by the federal courts where they have found sexually hostile environments or where they have not. What we have here is a situation where a few people, different times, different places are called in. One is found to have been in a sexually hostile environment where the only conduct that we can discern is that at some point during her tenure, Mr. Young asked her if she had a boyfriend. I think the difficulty is we have a few unrelated instances. We have a very difficult human being, I'll admit, to Mr. Young. But as the testimony showed, that even from some of these same witnesses, that some of his conduct or his demanding attitude was addressed to his son as much as it was addressed to the other folks in the office. But if simple lack of politeness or occasional boorish behavior were the basis for an attorney to be suspended essentially for 2 years at the end of his career, then we have a situation, I believe, in Ohio where many, many attorneys could be subject to this sort of situation.
Counsel, just be sure that the record is clear after what I've said, you're quite correct. That's a disputed fact. Respondent told Crowe that he had discussed the matter with his wife and agreed with Crowe, and therefore before apologized for his inappropriate comments. That's a disputed fact, not admitted.
Well, let me say, Mr. Young's wife is in that office on a regular basis. She does assist in interviewing candidates for clerical assistance. So the credibility, I think, of somebody saying that he would make a comment of the sort to do it in the presence of his wife of over 40 years, to me, simply doesn't wash.
You have less than 2 minutes if you want to save it. Mr. Berlew, you want to save your time for rebuttal? Ms. Brown?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Lori Brown. I'm counsel for Amicus Curiae Disciplinary Counsel in this case. First of all, Disciplinary Counsel has filed a brief in support of the Cincinnati Bar Association's position that Mr. Young violated DR 1102B. We do not believe, and we have said so in our brief, that a prior finding by an organization such as the EEOC or a prior judicial finding that an individual attorney engaged in sexual harassment and sexual discrimination is required prior to a finding by this court that the attorney violated DR 1102B. The reasons for that are as follows. First of all, this court adopted DR 1102B and became effective July 1, 1994. By so adopting this rule the way it is written, this court has already decided that issue. In other words, this court has already decided that the Board of Commissioners on Grievances and Discipline is completely capable of determining and making recommendations as to whether an attorney's conduct is, in fact, sexual harassment. In this case, the respondent raises briefly the issue of whether the statute of limitations requirements are somehow skewed because in a sexual harassment case, an individual has but 6 months to bring a charge of harassment with the EEOC, and in a disciplinary case, there are, in effect, no statutes of limitation. Disciplinary counsel's position on this is that the overriding need to protect the public simply outweighs any question about the application of the statute of limitations. Obviously, as this court has decided, if an issue is completely too stale, just simply too stale, it's going to be dismissed anyway during the course of the disciplinary investigation and determination by this court. But the issue of statute of limitations comparison between federal cases and a disciplinary case is simply not an issue. Finally, the ultimate determination as to whether sexual harassment has occurred in this case and in any others in which a charge under DR 1102B is brought is going to be made by a court, and that is by this court. This court is going to look at the record, as it stated in Heck versus Levin, you're going to look at the record and determine whether the board was correct in making a finding that the respondent violated DR 1102B. Probably one of the most important issues to recognize, and this also goes into the argument of whether sexual harassment occurred in this case, is that we're not talking about civil liability. No one has sued Mr. Young under any federal or state law alleging that he sexually harassed them. What we're talking about here is an attorney's conduct. Conduct during the course of his professional relationship with a series of individuals, three of whom testified at this hearing. And that is what the issue before this court is, whether his conduct regarding those individuals violates DR 1102B. We don't want to have to require individuals such as Elizabeth Crow, Jennifer Crow, Jessica Henn, and Emma Theda to have to go through EEOC proceedings, for example, before an attorney such as Mr. Young can be brought to justice before this court. Justice Douglas raised an issue as to whether a specific finding of illegal conduct would be required, and we would refer this court to the cases of Disciplinary Counsel versus Clifton and Disciplinary Counsel versus Romanu. And those are two cases in particular where this court found a violation of DR 1102A3, which says the lawyer shall not engage in conduct involving moral turpitude, while in fact, Mr. Clifton was tried for a crime and found that there was not proved beyond a reasonable doubt. He was acquitted of the crimes for which he was tried, and this court nevertheless found that he engaged in illegal conduct involving moral turpitude. At the time Christine Romanu was disciplined by this court, she had not yet been charged nor convicted of a crime. She has since, but at the time, she had not been charged or convicted. Finally, there are several states which provide explicit and very useful guidance on this issue of whether 1102B can be applied by this court prior to a determination that sexual harassment has occurred. Those cases are out of the states of Iowa, Indiana, Minnesota, New York, and there are judicial cases from the states of Minnesota, Florida, and California. And in all those cases, and in particular the attorney cases, the case from Iowa, and the Indiana case, and the Minnesota cases, they're almost exactly on point with the issues raised by respondents. The facts are very similar, and in fact, the sanctions are sometimes more harsh than has been recommended in this case. Dealing very briefly with the issue of whether the relator in this case, the Cincinnati Bar Association, proved that sexual harassment occurred. First of all, we would encourage the court to look at the big picture. Look at the instance where we have a roughly 62-year-old male attorney. He wants young, white females working in his office. The evidence proves that clearly and convincingly. He gets them there. He had 68 different employees in less than 3 years between 1995 and 1997. All of those individuals were young, white females. Some of them married, some of them single. And we would submit that if he had 68 employees, imagine how many he interviewed, which is a large part of this case. A lot of his misconduct occurred during the interviews with Elizabeth Crowe in particular. Once he hires those individuals, he doesn't give them anything to do. They merely sit there for whatever purpose we can only surmise. There is no purpose to them being there, it would appear. He takes them on errands with him for the purpose of showing them off to people. He takes them to the Cincinnati Inquirer where he knows individuals. He talks to them, introduces them as his legal assistants, but yet they do know legal work for him. He treats everyone in the office abusively. Everyone testified that he made individuals cry. In fact, even one of the witness that was called by the panel, Melanie Goodnell, testified that she had observed employees crying. Jessica Henn testified that she cried, and in response, he hugged her and told her to tell everyone that they had bonded. He tries to keep his employees, those individuals, the young single white females, quiet by telling them that if they talk to anyone else, he's going to fire them. And then he tells them that he has power over them. He had power to influence their bar applications. We would encourage you to find that Mr. Young did in fact violate 1102B, in this case, the first impression. And I will turn the podium to my co-counsel, Bill Clements.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Mr. Clements. Characterization of the allegation that he tended to use his position in the character and fitness process to that he could affect their fortune in the character and fitness process. Is that clear in the record?
The record is clear. Three witnesses testified remarkably with almost using the same words to describe the language that a respondent used in discussing his ability to influence their fitness to practice law past that examination later from the time. Ken Seda and Elizabeth Crowe all mentioned separately. Respondent claims that because he did not actually have the ability to influence the family, they therefore did not violate DR 911C, but I think the facts belie a different result. With Elizabeth Crowe, from the very first meeting by phone, there was discussion about the fact that she was an aspiring attorney and that he had, using her words, an edge over her because he would have to fill out the witness report. The very last words, according to her testimony, that she had with the respondent, after Elizabeth Crowe witnessed a co-worker being struck by a respondent, after witnessing this diatribe, screaming fit of rage from respondent, after having told respondent, "I quit," leaving the premises, his very last words to her were, "Remember, I have to fill out the witness report." Now, what purpose is that statement? Does it serve in this case? It serves to tell as a threat to this aspiring lawyer, do not report a behavior of which I am ashamed that you just witnessed.
Is that a disputed fact?
Yes, it is a disputed fact.
So,
relays a similar experience. After having been told to sit in a chair, doing nothing to legal assistance, but she became very frustrated with it. And after having, again, experienced one of his fits of rage, and after having advised that she was no longer to continue his employment, was once again reminded, now, what is the intent behind that? This is a disputed fact.
Is that a disputed fact?
But it's the second witness saying the same thing the second time. But what's his purpose behind this? Is it to prevent her or threaten her or deter her from reporting this misconduct? How could he report knowledgeably to the bar of examiners anyway? He had none of these people do anything that he could use to evaluate their performance. Clearly, it's a DR-911C violation. Respondent also argues in its brief that there was never really an attempt to influence the bar examiners, but this court, Atkins, says little comfort was found in the fact the spoken word did not heighten the conduct. I think that answers that argument very clearly. In each of these cases, the conduct of the respondent was inflicted on people who aspire to be lawyers, who look forward to doing what we do. That in each case, he snuffed out that camera. Emicida continues to work towards becoming a lawyer. She's in law school. Elizabeth Crowe works as a legal secretary at a firm in Washington, D.C. As she testified, Emicida, I wish you could have seen her demeanor. She was literally brought to tears by this experience, and she testified that to this day she's still frightened that that experience is going to have some impact on her ability to earn a living as a lawyer. I do not believe there is any objection in the records to finding that respondent's conduct and this touching or striking of Jennifer Crowe on that fateful Saturday in April violated DRA 102A6. That finding was made by the board, the panel of the board, and I don't see any objection in any of the respondents' literature and argument that conduct and the touching or the striking, however you want to characterize it, of Jennifer Crowe occurred, and that it indeed could violate DR 102A6. There is a litany of conduct in this case. As I look at this, I'm not a discrimination lawyer. I have very little experience in civil rights discrimination practice. I look at it as a lawyer. Rob looks at it. Our profession is accosted regularly with stories about bad lawyering, bad lawyers. And as far as I'm concerned, we can forget whether or not there's a discrimination. Violation of federal discrimination law here in Ohio. We have I know the relator does not agree with me in that endeavor, but we have frequent losses of temper We have profane, derogatory language, employees crying, inappropriate sexual comments, hugging employees, nicknames. 68 clerical employees were confirmed. They had just 10 clerical employees on the average. We have respondents on council admonishing him to respect the panel, admonishing him to answer questions that were presented by the panel. All of this together reflects very, very poorly on respondents' ability to fitness to practice law. And I love you, of course, as the court's precedent. I found a case of disciplinary counsel versus Campbell. It goes back for ER on 102B. In that case, a lawyer and a judge made suggestive comments to women in his law practice and in his courtroom. He actually made unwanted touching of some female court personnel and female employees of his law firm.
Is that necessary? something that is wrong. In fact, that might be a good thing to do. Say, here's witnesses. You're against us, but I'm a hard person to work for, and at the end of the day, I'm going to think that.
Each of these witnesses took on that responsibility. They said, well, great, this is a chance for me to build my credentials to become a lawyer. But it turned out to be completely different. The respondent used it as a threat to force conformity on the behavior, which is a sexually harassing workplace and a violation of DR 11286.
So in the way that he stated it in the initial interview, it was regarded as this could be a plus for the reason he considered working here.
That I believe is the way it was stated. It's not the way it turned out, but the way it was initially stated. And again, I think the panel had the opportunity to look at these employment relationships from beginning to end, not snapshot fashion. They viewed the demeanor of these witnesses, each of whom were very credible and forthright, and nothing became
a testimony to your employment.
And after listening to that testimony and hearing the context,
Martin,
could you use your word, that respondent made these threats within the end of the relationship, realized that it constituted a violation of the law. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Clemens. Mr. Ballou, you have a little less than a minute.
This is so unfortunate, so I'll go quickly. But this very council says happened, did not happen. Never argued, never suggested, never proved that this was for young white women. The problem with this case is that none of these things individually constitute sexual harassment, as they argued. This court has laid down for all of us what that is. You'll not see any term like comparative, hostile work environment ever used. But this is where you're dead for character and fitness. The court asked us what's the character of this person. I'm going to tell the court, you don't do a good job if you don't do a good job. The other part of this is the way he was treated. We disclosed 68 prior employees to Related. They never identified witnesses prior to trial. We had to either depose 68 witnesses, say, well, one for column A, one for column B, one for column C. In this case, there was nothing involving communications with another lawyer, a client, a court, or a line. None of it. If you look at the complaint, what is being done is outrageous. It goes from things like, you can't go to Wendy's restaurant, you're crazy, none of this is proved. The psychiatrist says there's nothing wrong with this man, there is behavior. The argument which Relator is making is for the businessman whose goods he can't sell for a profit, he's going to make up for in volume. None of these cases that are said under any opinion that you have given constitutes sexual harassment. Only thing that happened in this case, I mean, I've never seen one like this. Nothing goes to practice of law. Nothing, those words sexual harassment, are not used as words of art, which is why it's part of that.
Does the code professional responsibility only apply to the practice of law?
No, it does not. Absolutely it doesn't. That's the unusual feature. But in this case, none of it goes to law, a lawyer, lying to a tribunal, doing anything contrary to your oath of office. You know what? In these facts, there's no sex. The sexual harassment, if they say this man hugged a secretary in front of the other employees and said we bonded, you would throw that out so quickly if it were prosecuted on a sexual harassment charge. And it's unfortunate, but in the assault, supposedly with the employee, he was embarrassed. He resolved it very kindly, confidentially with the secretary. Relator did not produce her to say anything differently. Young's testimony was consistent, and the officious interloper looking from the opposite side said, I saw this assault.
Okay, no sexual harassment, no sexual connotations. Now, I accept it's a disputed fact, but it certainly has some connotation, and the board made it very clear in their report that they judged the credibility of these witnesses, and particularly the respondent, and vis-a-vis the witnesses, and they did because of his wife, who was also allegedly there, and the secretary or the office manager who was making $70,000 a year. Let me just finish.
That's such a terrible conclusion.
All right, well, let me just finish with it. Is it a sexual connotation for him to sit there and say, are you a virgin, in an interview?
Well, I would not do it. I have a professional wife, okay. Professional daughters. I think it's boorish and stupid.
Okay. But is it a sexual connotation to say...
Not the way this court or every federal court has defined that. And to say that a person, you're incredible, although you left a wonderful life because you married a man who can't believe you. Then for the board to call the witness out of the blue to say, Mr. Young is exactly right. And then to resolve it in the favor of the relator. It's not right. And I don't know, but for a while, Mr. Clement was describing some of the behavior. I'm trying to think of how many lawyers I've worked for like that until it got to a point. Loud, abrasive, tough business, tough to do. And sometimes you cry, but in none of those cases was there ever a quid pro quo, never comparative, never McDonnell Douglas standard used. And that's the problem. This case has been argued contrary to everybody you have told us we have to argue sexual harassment cases because they use the words and the terms as what they think they mean, not the way you have told us they mean, and not the way the Ohio Civil Rights Commission and EEOC as a 360-day statute, not 6 months, has been used. I would hate it. Every lawyer would hate to say, given everybody that's ever worked for you, I'm going to go through all of them. We're going to prosecute you by handcuffs. That's the other scariest part. What there is just anecdotal stories. And even though you're looking at it and say, no, this isn't it. Well, if you say no every time, and I think when you add them together, it doesn't make any yes. And those are problems you can wait to face across that.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.
All right.